It's Tuesday, February 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Coming up this half hour, the U.S. Senate begins debate on immigration. The result defies prediction. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson wades into the complexities of the Middle East, and playwright Eve Ensler working to find a woman's voice in the theater.
Not only have I been trying to get back into my body, but I've been really working to find ways to support women coming back into their bodies. And cancer did the trick.
It's all ahead for you this half hour on International Edition. Russian investigators are examining possible causes to Sunday's passenger plane crash that left all 71 people on board an Antonov 148 twin-engine jet dead shortly after takeoff from a Moscow airport. Russia's transport minister, Maxim Sokolov, here said that the first task of the special organized commission will be to organize logistics, adding it is far too early to draw any conclusions about the loss of the Saratov Airlines plane. Hundreds of people and dozens of vehicles have been deployed to collect debris, human remains, and search for the flight and cockpit data recorders, the so-called black boxes. Todd Curtis is founder of the website airsafe.com. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty that images he has seen lead him to believe that the aircraft broke apart shortly after takeoff.
What was shown was essentially fairly small pieces of wreckage widely scattered, which implies to me that since there's no central crash location with a lot of wreckage, that this aircraft very likely broke up in midair.
What would cause that?
There are any number of things that could cause this sort of thing to happen. In fact, in 2011, another aircraft, the same model, was in a flight test mode where it went into a high-speed situation and lost control and literally shook apart in midair. And it, too, was an in-flight breakup. As it turns out, other reports indicate that this aircraft went into a fairly aggressive descent, roughly twice the rate that you would see in a normal aircraft descent, shortly before it disappeared from radar. So it implies that perhaps this airplane was in a rather high-speed situation for that phase of flight.
This is a fairly new aircraft manufactured just 8 years ago.
The Antonov 148 was a fairly short production run. There were less than 50 of these aircraft made, and in fact, the production, to the best of my knowledge, ceased in 2017. And there are only a handful of operators around the world that use this model aircraft.
There was a suggestion by one consultant that the disappearance of the aircraft could indicate the jet's transponder lost power. What would be the importance of that?
Well, I think it would be entirely too early to speculate as to why the aircraft may have not communicated with the outside world or may have dropped off of radar. And again, this is very early in the investigation. I'm sure the Russian authorities are fully capable of figuring out exactly the sequence of events that happened from the time this aircraft took off to the time it was lost to radar.
According to one report, the last large-scale crash in Russia occurred back on Christmas Day 2016 when a Tupolev 154 operated by the Russian Defense Ministry on its way to Syria crashed into the Black Sea. All 92 people on board were killed. How would you rate Russia's aviation safety record?
Russia has a very impressive history in aviation development, from airliners to spaceships and such. In short, the Russian and before that the Soviet system developed in parallel to what was happening in Europe and America and elsewhere. So there are some essential differences in how the earlier Soviet-era jets and aircraft were designed and some differences in operation. But that said, in the modern era, especially in the almost 30 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall and the over 25 years since the ending of the Soviet Union, most of the major Russian airlines are actually flying the same jets and the same turboprops you would see in Europe and North America. And their operational behavior is very similar to what you see in larger operators in the West. The jet that crashed was from one of the smaller operators, and it was operating domestically. And this is going to be part of the investigation. Were there some things about domestic flight operations for this airline that would have been fundamentally different from what you would see in an international operation? And did those differences in any way lead to this crash?
Tragically, this crash came just weeks after two groups, the Dutch aviation consultancy TO70 and the Aviation Safety Network, proclaimed 2017 the safest year for aviation ever, with no commercial passenger jet fatalities. In Washington, meanwhile, the U.S. Senate voted 97-1 late Monday to begin an extensive debate on immigration reform as partisan differences swiftly emerged on the scope and substance of what lawmakers hope to see in a final package. VOA Capitol correspondent Michael Bowman has that story.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell promised an open floor process to see which immigration proposals, if any, can get three-fifths backing and advance in the chamber.
Now's the time to back up the talk with the hard work of finding a workable solution, an agreement that can pass the Senate, pass the House, and which the president will sign.
In theory, there is no limit to the number of immigration proposals senators could offer.
This is kind of a strange way to operate. We've never done it before.
Democrat Dianne Feinstein told VOA she expects an initial flurry of partisan proposals and amendments.
The first would likely be a Republican bill. The second, a Democratic bill, will probably both go down. And then maybe the third bill will be the compromise.
Republican Susan Collins is a key member of a bipartisan working group in the Senate.
I think it's doable. We're working on our bipartisan Common Sense Coalition proposal, which I expect we will be releasing later this week.
Various legislative proposals will aim to protect young immigrants who will be at risk of deportation beginning March 5th. They will differ in their embrace or exclusion of President Donald Trump's other priorities, including border wall construction and changes to America's legal immigration system. Michael Bowman, VOA News, The Capitol.
These are some of the top stories trending at this hour. The United States has charged five ex-Venezuelan officials with bribery. The Tonganese capital faces widespread damage in the wake of Cyclone Gita. Turkey issues an ultimatum to Washington ahead of Secretary of State Tillerson's visit. And Pakistan's media authority tells broadcasters not to speak about Valentine's Day. Extended coverage of these and more stories on our news site, voanews.com, and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
It's raining outside and your joints and back are hurting, so there's got to be a connection between the two, right? Well, not really. Researchers at the Harvard Medical School have released a new study that suggests there is no link between rainy days and joint or back pain. The Harvard researchers made their findings after sifting through and analyzing insurance records of more than 11 million doctor visits by older Americans between 2008 and 2012, along with daily rainfall data gathered by thousands of National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration weather stations. Study leader Anupam Jena, a professor of healthcare policy at Harvard, says that no matter how they looked at the data, they didn't see any connection between rainfall and physician visits for joint or back pain. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition coming to you live from Washington, D.C. I'm Doug Bernard. Turning our attention elsewhere now, South Africa's tense political crisis reached a peak Monday as leaders of the ruling African National Congress met to demand President Jacob Zuma's resignation after more than a week of unsuccessful negotiations. But the opposition vowed that is not the end of the nation's political turmoil, calling for early elections to replace Zuma. Here now, VOA's Anita Powell with the latest from Johannesburg.
South Africa's political crisis will not be resolved with the exit of unpopular President Jacob Zuma, the nation's newly unified opposition party said Monday, as the top executives of the ruling African National Congress met to demand Zuma's exit. The coalition of opposition parties announced Monday that they are seeking to move up a planned no-confidence vote in Parliament, the ninth such vote Zuma has faced. Previous votes have failed because Zuma enjoyed the support of the ruling party, which he has now lost. An opposition coalition led by the Democratic Alliance and the far-left Economic Freedom Fighters says it will demand Parliament be dissolved and early elections held once Zuma is out. Economic Freedom Fighters leader Julius Malema says the opposition is not content to allow Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa to hold Zuma's seat until elections in mid-2019.
They want Zuma to go because it's the time for Cyril's group to eat. And they call it a transition. Transition from what? It can't be a transition. It's not a transition. That is an abuse of concepts. It's a factions changing, swapping seats. It's not a transition, it's a swapping from one corrupt fellow to another corrupt fellow.
The opposition and many South Africans have been calling for Jacob Zuma to step down for years as he has sunk deeper into growing, widening corruption scandals, protected by the ANC's comfortable majority in parliament. But since the ANC replaced Zuma as party head in December, Ramaphosa, his successor as party leader, has been working to push him out of the presidency as well. This past week, top ANC members have privately met with Zuma to try to convince him to resign. Ramaphosa said Sunday the ANC knew South Africans were losing patience.
The successful resolution of this matter has great significant consequences for the country and for the African National Congress. We know you want closure on this matter. Comrades, as you do want closure, we will be doing so, keeping our eyes on what is in the interest of all our people and how we continue to unite the nation.
But Ramaphosa's new job will not be easy, especially if the opposition makes headway in its quest to push him out, says analyst Daniel Silk.
But I think Ramaphosa is a wily character, someone who has the ear of both domestic and foreign business interests in South Africa. And there's a large body of South Africans, ordinary South Africans, who are desperate for political change and who will give him the benefit of the doubt, even if he has to compromise on some of these challenges that he will face.
And Zuma is unlikely to enjoy an easy retirement. He could face numerous corruption investigations, including a pending case that includes 783 charges of corruption. Anita Pell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Wading into a scenario of mounting regional tensions, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson began a five-nation visit to the Middle East in the Egyptian capital of Cairo, where he called for next month's presidential elections to be transparent and credible. The top U.S. diplomat met Monday with Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry and touched on topics including economic and military cooperation and the fight against terrorism. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Secretary Tillerson held a joint news conference with Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry at the old Foreign Ministry compound, highlighting topics of concern to both countries, including the fight against terrorism and U.S. concerns about Egypt's presidential elections. Both men stressed that they had agreed not to interfere in each other's internal affairs. Tillerson noted that both he and Shoukry had discussed the promotion and protection of human rights and the vital role of civil society in Egypt, along with issues related to the upcoming Egyptian presidential election in March, in which incumbent President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is running largely unopposed.
The United States, as it does in all countries, supports a transparent and credible electoral process, and all citizens being given the right and the opportunity to participate freely and fairly.
When asked about alleged political oppression in Egypt, Foreign Minister Shoukry responded that the political process takes a long time to evolve, but that Egyptians have expressed their views at the ballot box, along with changing their government several times during the past 7 years.
Development in the social and political field is an evolutionary process. I think over the last 11 years, the Egyptian people have shown their commitment and the determination and their ability to change their course and to indicate their dissatisfaction. If they deemed that they were dissatisfied, they have been able to change two governments in the last 7 years, and they have undertaken legislative elections and know how to protect their rights and to advocate.
Secretary Tillerson stressed that both the U.S. and Egypt were determined to jointly pursue the fight against terrorism, and that Egypt was a key member of the U.S.-led coalition against the so-called Islamic State group.
We agreed that we would continue our close cooperation on counterterrorism measures, including our joint commitment to the defeat of ISIS. And Egypt has been a very important member of the Defeat ISIS coalition from the beginning. Egypt deals with the threats of ISIS themselves and are dealing with it certainly currently in the Sinai.
Egypt began a countrywide anti-terrorism operation dubbed Sinai 2018 on Friday and has been launching airstrikes against terrorist targets, including arms caches, as well as attempting to disrupt arms supply routes from Libya and Gaza. In response to an Arab journalist's question about U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of the State of Israel, Tillerson insisted that the U.S. remain committed to the peace process and that several key points of the president's decision were being misinterpreted.
In the announcement President Trump made regarding Jerusalem, he also made two very important points as well, one of which was he was not advocating for any change to the status quo as to oversight of the holy sites, recognizing the proper role of existing authorities. And the second is that the final boundaries of Jerusalem are yet to be determined, and that those will be decided among the parties.
When asked about Egypt's relations with North Korea, Foreign Minister Shoukry pointed out that many U.S. allies also have diplomatic ties with Pyongyang, but went on to stress that economic and other ties were minimal.
Egypt has had normal diplomatic ties with North Korea, as does many Western and NATO members, and those ties are, in terms of the relationship, limited to representation, and there is almost no existing economic or other areas of cooperation.
Secretary Tillerson added that the U.S. was still evaluating eventual diplomatic negotiations with North Korea, but pointed out that it's up to Pyongyang to decide when they're ready to engage with the U.S. in a sincere and meaningful way, since they know what has to be on the table for discussions. Tillerson met with President al-Sisi at the Al-Ittihadiyya Presidential Palace before heading to the airport and continuing his tour that will include stops in Kuwait, Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
A brief passing moment of history in Washington on Monday. The National Portrait Gallery unveiled portraits of former President Barack Obama and former First Lady Michelle Obama. Barack Obama's portrait was painted by Kehinde Wiley, an artist best known for his vibrant, large-scale paintings of African Americans. For Michelle Obama's portrait, the gallery commissioned Baltimore-based artist Amy Sherald, first prize winner of the Portrait Gallery's 2016 Outwin Butcher Portrait Competition. The former president said this was a new experience for him and his wife.
Like Michelle, I have never had a portrait done of myself. I mean, the Hope poster by Shep was cool, but I didn't sit for it. Nobody in my family tree, as far as I can tell, had a portrait done.
Mr. Obama said artist Wiley is noted for highlighting subjects that generally are not readily noticed by the public.
People who helped to build this country. People who helped to build this capital, people who to this day are making sure that this place is clean at night and serving food and taking out the garbage and doing all the other stuff that makes this country work, so often out of sight and out of mind.
The paintings were unveiled at the gallery, which is part of the Smithsonian Group of Museums. The gallery has a complete collection of presidential portraits. You're listening to International Edition from the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition coming to you live from Washington. I'm Doug Bernard. Author, actress, and activist Eve Ensler is having a busy winter. Her one-woman show, In the Body of the World, based on her memoir about surviving uterine cancer, just opened off Broadway. And V-Day, a global activist movement that she started to end violence against women and girls, is now celebrating its 20th anniversary this month. Jeff London reports.
Eve Ensler has dedicated her life and work to women's issues around the world, and theater director Diane Paulus wanted to collaborate with her.
I mean, if there's anyone who walks the walk, it's Eve Ensler.
Paulus had read Ensler's memoir and saw in it the basis of a one-woman show.
I thought it was some of her best writing because it was signature Eve. Philosophy, politics, feminism, all told through humor and her point of view, which she does not shy away from. But it was so deeply personal.
So Paulus arranged to meet Eve Ensler in her Manhattan loft.
She came over and I read the book to her. It took 5 hours. We took a couple of pee breaks and that was it. Yeah.
They began an intense process to translate that book into a play. In it, Ensler describes walking the walk. She spent years visiting war zones and was helping victims of rape and torture in the Congo.
I think what really struck me about the Congo was the kind of synergistic cauldron of colonialism, capitalism, racism, insane misogyny. You know, all of those violences kind of being enacted on the bodies of women.
Ensler was creating a women's leadership community and sanctuary for survivors of gender violence there called City of Joy when her own life got upended.
And it's almost impossible building something in the middle of a war zone. You don't have roads, you don't have electricity, you don't have... It was madness. And as that's all in chaos, I got diagnosed with stage 3-4 uterine cancer. The alchemy of it all was just, you know, change or die.
So how'd I get it? Was it tofu? I ate a lot of tofu. Was it failing at marriage? Twice. Was it worry every single day for 56 years that I wasn't good enough?
In the Body of the World toggles between the harrowing journey Ensler took to fight the cancer, her own painful family history, and her connection to women and nature in the outside world. Ensler says her own experiences with rape and abuse caused her to mentally disconnect from her body.
And so I think my whole life, not only have I been trying to get back into my body, but I've been really working to find ways to support women coming back into their bodies. And cancer did the trick, as well as building City of Joy, because those two things together, you know, we were building a place where women could come back into their bodies.
Women's bodies are the central focus of Ensler's signature work, The Vagina Monologues. Originally written as a celebration of vaginas and femininity, Ensler says the purpose of the piece changed to a movement to stop violence against women. 20 years ago, on February 14th, the first V-Day was held when productions of the play in professional theaters, colleges, and even living rooms raised millions of dollars towards women's causes. For the anniversary, 3,000 performances are scheduled.
I'm so emotional right now coming up on the 20th anniversary. You know, when I think 20 years ago how hard it was to say the word vagina, you know, how crazy everybody thought it was, you know, and then to see how women, amazing women across the world, across this country, took this play, brought it into their communities, were brave enough to put it on.
And all because Eve Ensler has been brave enough to walk the walk as an advocate for women's issues for decades. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And for all of us here in Studio 25, thank you so much for being with us today. News available 24 hours a day at our website, voanews.com. We'll see you again tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Afghanistan has worked hard to improve governance and security over the past months. This is an important year for Afghanistan, and I'm optimistic that the country is making great strides on the road to peace and development, said Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan during his recent trip to Kabul. He applauded government reforms aimed at improving governance, security, and inclusiveness. I'm heartened by the progress Afghanistan has made in so many areas, he said. I'd like to congratulate the government of Afghanistan on the successes they have achieved thus far in implementing the Afghanistan Compact since it was launched in August of 2017. The Compact is an Afghan-led initiative meant to demonstrate the government's commitment to creating a peaceful, stable, and prosperous society. The initiative was a key consideration for the United States when developing the U.S. South Asia policy launched by President Trump in August of last year. We have already seen a number of reforms, including crackdowns on corruption throughout the government and application of the rule of law by jailing a number of high-ranking officials for corruption. Implementation of these reforms carries with it opportunities to improve the delivery of government services, stem official corruption, and prepare for secure national elections, she said. Deputy Secretary Sullivan also praised the Afghan government's plan to improve the country's security by bringing 80% of Afghanistan's territory under government control. Nonetheless, the United States firmly believes that ultimately the peace and security of Afghanistan will not be determined only on the battlefield, but through peace talks. We are prepared for the long run, in partnership with the Afghan government, to keep the pressure on the Taliban, to convince them that there isn't a military solution, and that ultimately a peaceful resolution of this conflict is what's ultimately going to attain, said Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan. We support Afghanistan's progress with our South Asia strategy, which sends a clear message that the Taliban cannot wait us out because our commitment to Afghanistan is not based on a timeline. We have an enduring partnership, and we'll work with the Afghan government to ensure that Afghanistan is able to prevent terrorists from exploiting its territory to threaten the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.